Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Two-thirds of low-wage workers claim that their employers broke at least one pay-related law that week. While that may just have been a claim, Walmart, for example, was found guilty of not paying some workers the required overtime. Half of U.S. employees admit to lying on their resume. Three-quarters admit to cyber-loafing on the job, you know, shopping on the net during work time or playing a video game and then switching to a spreadsheet when the boss comes around. Cheating in the workplace. The new book, Cheating, its first paragraph is, cheating is deeply embedded in everyday life. Costs attributable to the most common forms total close to $1 trillion annually in the U.S. alone. Later in the book, the author writes, quote, the cost of cheating in organizations is staggering. The typical organization loses an estimated 5% of its revenue each year to fraud. When employees cheat on safety-related matters, the price may not just be in dollars, but in human lives, as recent scandals involving car manufacturers attest, GM and Volkswagen. Between one-third and one-half of employees observe unethical conduct on the job. Part of the problem is that many individuals fail to see such behavior as a problem. Oh, everyone does it. It's common rationalization. And I'm still quoting, by the way. This is still a quote from the book. And a rationalization that comes uncomfortably close to the truth. That perception is also self-perpetuating. The more that individuals believe cheating is widespread, the easier it becomes to justify. That is how cultures of dishonesty take root. End quote. With me on the line is the author of the book Cheating, Stanford professor and founding director of Stanford Center on Ethics, Deborah Rhode. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure indeed. Let's start by defining terms. It's clearly cheating for a salesperson or a fundraiser to lie about how much benefit their dollars will yield. It's clearly cheating to exaggerate on your resume. But how about, for example, take your institution. I don't know if it goes on at Stanford, but certainly at many colleges. College administrators extol the importance of training, treating labor fairly, but then they hire lots of PhD-holding faculty, part-time, temp, bad pay, to avoid paying benefits or giving security of employment. Would that be considered cheating?
Well, I think those kinds of circumstances raise definitional issues because they don't involve outright lying, but they could involve withholding information that would clearly affect employees' choices. And in that last situation you describe, I suspect the problem is not misinformation, but desperation. Part-time faculty aren't deceived, but they're just unable to find other positions that offer more equitable pay and benefits.
Yep.
And the solution there lies with changing the economics of higher education, something that's not within the power of college administrators to accomplish on their own.
Well, Stanford's endowment would belie that, but I guess that's a bit off topic. But let's move to what are more common definitions of cheating. You cite studies that, and I'm again quoting from your book, quote, estimates of employee theft range from $50 billion to $200 billion per year. Would you read us? I hope you have a copy of the book in front of you. Great. You have a section called Forms of Cheating. This will be a way for us to kind of make clearer practical definitions of what we're really referring to regarding cheating. It starts in the middle of page 38. And if you read all the way through to two-thirds of page 40, ending with the words wage theft, that would be great.
All right. In From Hire to Liar, The Role of Deception in the Workplace, David Shulman describes a wide variety of cheating for which organizations pay the price. Workers in his study, like those in other research, spent hours talking on the phone to friends, doing personal errands, and cyberloafing, surfing the internet, shopping online, social networking, and playing video games. Online slacking has become increasingly common. Studies of United States workers have found that between 64 to 90% acknowledge using the internet for recreational purposes during work hours, and that organizations lose a staggering amount of productive time as a consequence. In one typical case, an employee set up his computer so he could play games but switched the screen to a financial spreadsheet with a single click if someone walked by. Another way to cheat organizations involves resume fraud. Studies find that between 40% to 53% of resumes include false claims, most often involving educational credentials, work experience, and prior salaries. Other workers shortchange organizations in less conventional ways. One individual in Shulman's study worked for a state during the summer clearing a river of debris. When he and his colleagues failed to find enough debris, they arranged with the fire department to bring them wood that they could hose down and pretend to have found in the river. Their supervisors were aware of the deception, but in their view, wood was being found, jobs were being saved, and that's all that mattered. In another case, a software consultant summarized common attitudes with uncommon candor. My real job at work is to do as little work as possible while getting paid as much as possible. That's it, and I don't feel bad about it at all. If questioned about his delays in completing a task, he simply explained that I ran into a problem, and his colleagues were too busy with their own work to notice that he was not busy with his. Other forms of cheating occur at much higher and costlier levels. On Wall Street, some traders have engaged in what they call pump and dump. They encourage clients to bid up the stock price of a company above its market value, and they then sell their own stock, held illegally under assumed names by fellow conspirators, before the price tumbles. Investors can lose millions of dollars. In Moral Mazes, sociologist Robert Jackal recounts the unhappy history of an accountant who stumbled on pension fraud orchestrated by the CEO. When the accountant reported it, a vice president told him to forget the whole thing. Everybody does it. That's just part of the game in business today. William Aramany, the CEO of United Way, evidently held the same view. His personal use of organizational funds resulted in convictions for fraud, conspiracy, and money laundering. He diverted money donated for charitable causes to fund a European vacation and pay an $80,000 salary for his girlfriend's hour or so of work. In the aftermath of the scandal, donations dropped by over 15% in some United Way chapters.
You know, I think I'm going to have you stop there, lest we go too long. Right. I didn't realize how long it would take to read all that. But it really, I love that section because it shows across the board, from the very top level executives to the worker, it really is, to substantiate your claim, very pervasive, the amount of unethical behavior. Before we go further, there's something that goes through my head. I have a number of clients who would say, in terms of defending workplace, you know, various kinds of either, you know, playing around on the internet or stealing or padding expense accounts or whatever, they say, you know, corporate America is screwing me. It's only giving myself a fair share of it back. It's trivial in comparison. And besides, my life, the world has treated me poorly. You know, I've seen more qualified people get hired, less qualified people get hired over me, less qualified people get promoted. I'm just doing a drop in the bucket. Don't give me your high-mindedness. What would you say in response to that person?
Well, it's a common form of rationalization, and I think the best way to respond is to say, well, what if everybody did that? Where would we be in this society if everyone thought they could cheat just whenever they could get away with it, and that it was okay because other people did?
Well, what if they said he or she responded and said, you know, first of all, everybody is not going to do it. That's just a theoretical hypothesis. But more importantly, it would be a more just America. We would redistribute from, you know, we're playing Robin Hood, taking from, and I'm not talking about the CEO. I'm talking about your quote, middle class or working class or let alone low-wage worker, saying this is, our government won't redistribute enough. It's a more equitable society, and therefore it would be great if everybody played Robin Hood.
Well, you know, do you want to live in a world where anyone who isn't rich feels that they can cheat whenever it would serve their interests? Is that how you want to raise your kids? Is that how you think we build trust in society? And what makes you think that if you take that view, everybody else won't? We know from a vast amount of sociological research that the way that cheating cultures take hold is when people see or believe that cheating is widespread. So the more people do it, the more likely it is that they're going to encourage their peers to do it as well. And when that happens, basic norms that sustain a free market and a culture of trust in the workplace erode.
I note with great interest your use of the word trust twice. Indeed, this requires a almost cosmic belief in the obligation that individuals have to the commonweal. And is that a realistic goal, especially, you know, using Maslow's hierarchy of, you know, there are a lot of people who are struggling, or at minimal struggling to live and pay the rent in the Bay Area, they're, or splitting their medication in half. So is it a privileged kind of a sanctimony for us to say, you know, it's all well and good that if everybody did this, it would be a society of lack of trust. Is it realistic for us to ask people to be that broad-minded?
Well, I think that's the aspirational norm. And you recognize that if people are in desperate circumstances, you know, they're going to cut some corners, and most of us would feel more understanding of their plight than that of the CEO who does it. Mm-hmm. But my general proposition is that we don't want to live in a society when anyone who is not economically privileged feels that they're justified in taking advantage of every possible situation to cheat.
Yes. Now, turning to the issue of remediation, if you will, you know, there are certainly the kind of ethical discussions that go on, the dilemmas, the cases that get brought up in universities or in corporate trainings or nonprofit trainings, they're interesting, they're complex, they're gray area, they're vague. But in the vast, and you tell me if I'm wrong, you're the ethics expert, not me, but in the vast majority of malfeasance of various ethics, most people know they shouldn't be, except for during their break or lunch hour, they shouldn't be playing around during work time. Executives know they shouldn't be cooking the books. They choose expedience. So to what extent do you believe over decades, billions of dollars that have been spent to try to do ethics education in both in the workplace as well as universities, could that money not be better spent?
Yeah. Well, as a general matter, I think you're right that the problem has less to do with understanding that the conduct is wrong and more to do with being trapped in a reward system that makes honesty too expensive and a culture that doesn't sufficiently value integrity. But I guess as someone who teaches ethics in my day job, I do think that training and education can help. They can sensitize individuals to the adverse consequences of cheating for them, for their organizations, and for innocent third parties. They can give them of the structural causes that encourage cheating, and it can help them think through possible responses both at an individual and organizational level. We know that a lot of individuals cross ethical lines without giving a lot of thought or even consciousness to the fact that they're doing that. Psychologists call this the boiled frog problem. Mm-hmm. You know, if you put a frog in boiling water, it knows to jump out, but if you put it in tepid water and then gradually heat it, it will boil to death. It turns out that folk wisdom is wrong about frogs,
right,
but it is right about humans.
Yes, it makes
and
a lot of sense.
And it helps to have them think through responses before they have a vested interest in coming out one way or another.
Yeah. Let's take a shot at enlightening our already, at least I hope to believe the KLW listenership is more enlightened than the average. But first, I'd like to let our listeners know what you're listening to. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking about a topic I love, ethics in the workplace and outside, and a wonderful book, very well written and well documented. It's called Cheating, Subtitle Ethics in Everyday Life by Deborah Rode, who is a Stanford professor as well as the founding director of Stanford Center on Ethics. So enlighten us as to, you talked about the various stakeholders who get affected by cheating. It's not just the cheathead person or entity, but there are a variety of stakeholders that get affected. Why don't you lay that out for us?
Variety of stakeholders who are
affected by, if I cheat, if I'm, let's say, I'm playing on the internet, or I'm padding my expense account, or I'm a boss who's playing with the books, where, you know, who is affected other than the recipient?
Yeah. Well, I think the consequences cluster in three categories. First, there are the harms to the person who's cheated it or other third parties. Then there are harms to the cheater, and then there are harms to the general level of social trust. And the injuries are cumulative and hard to reverse. The harms to the cheaters, those who are cheated, are pretty self-evident. Mm-hmm. You know, by exempting themselves from rules that are generally observed, cheaters get unfair advantages and third parties pay the cost. The harms to the person who cheats are a little more subtle, but they include the loss in self-respect from inroads on integrity, and if the cheating is discovered, the damage to reputation and credibility, and sometimes legal liability.
Fair enough.
And I think cheating also distorts individuals' perceptions of their own abilities. Cheaters come to believe that they're smarter than they are, and they overestimate their performance.
Mm-hmm.
And with each act of cheating, the next comes more easily. It's sort of like with lying, that it just it's easy to tell one lie and hard to tell only one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then finally, there are the cost to society. Trust and cooperation depend on a general level of truthfulness. So we're all free riders on that culture, and individuals who don't observe rules that they expect others to observe are really undermining the social fabric.
Somebody who's listening to the show just wrote me a note and said, truth is, starts with truth is and a dash, the economically privileged engage in widespread lying and cheating, starting with the president. When the president gets away and benefits from lying and cheating, what kind of example is that for the rest of us? And yet, in your book and what we've discussed so far, is that cheating apparently is very widespread across the spectrum. But what is your answer to that listener?
I think he's absolutely right, and, you know, it's shameful that in this country less than a third of Americans have confidence in the honesty and integrity of the president, and, you know, so many millions voted for him anyway.
Yeah.
I think we just put too low a priority on those values, which is one reason why I wrote the book.
I think it's fair-minded to say, I've been, over the years, I've always found interesting the list of trusted professions and least trusted. And at the bottom, for decades now, but acceleratingly so, through the 90s, the 2000s, 2010s, lawyers and politicians and journalists scored near the bottom. So I think we all, you know, we see the well-publicized lyings and exaggerations and cheatings of Donald Trump. I think it's certainly, we can't lay that all at his feet, but it's more endemic to the way in which we elect our officials, by making them press the flesh and raise all that money to be our political leaders. Is that a fair assertion?
Well, you know, we could spend a whole hour on everything that's wrong with our current campaign finance system.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'd all be a lot better off if we could remove some money from politics. But, you know, that wasn't Donald Trump's problem. You know, he was plenty rich enough to finance his own campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are other deeper roots to, you know, the culture that enables him to think he can get away with it.
Right. Let's turn to an area which is, you know, everybody is happy to pile on lawyers. And you write a really interesting section. You are a lawyer yourself, and you were a professor in the law school, and you talk about lawyer overbilling, and you cite a particularly vivid example that one lawyer, quote, represented a pair of jogging shoes as ground transportation, end quote. And you also write about how many lawyers, otherwise smart people, rationalize padding their billings, double billings, etc. And you have a powerful quote about that. It starts on the bottom of page 8.
I got it.
Great. Would you read that to us?
Yeah. One day, not too long after you start practicing law, you'll sit down at the end of a long, tiring day, and you won't have much to show for your efforts in terms of billable hours. It'll be near the end of the month. You will know that all the partners will be looking at your monthly time report in a few days, so what you'll do is pad your timesheet just a bit. Maybe you'll bill a client for 90 minutes for a task that really took you only 60 minutes to perform. However, you'll promise yourself that you'll repay the client at the first opportunity by doing 30 minutes of work for the client for free, and in this way you'll be borrowing, not stealing. And then what will happen is it'll become a little easier and a little easier to take these little loans against future work. And then after a while, you'll stop paying back those little loans. You'll convince yourself that although you billed for 90 minutes and spent only 60 on the project, you did such good work that the client really should pay a bit more for it. And after all, our billing rate is awfully low and your client is awfully rich. And then you'll pad more and more. Every two-minute telephone conversation will go down on the sheet as 10 minutes. Every three-hour research project will go down with an extra quarter hour or so. You'll continue to rationalize your dishonesty to yourself in various ways until one day you stop even doing even that. And before long, it won't take much more than 3 or 4 years. You'll be stealing from your clients almost every day, and you won't even notice it.
Yep, we become inured. You know, if we get away with it, it becomes part of, we're on autopilot. And it just becomes, and we have these unconscious, if there is such a thing as an unconscious, rationalization about it. I am aware that we are disproportionately focusing on management and leadership, but I think, or people are, quote, of privilege, but I think it's probably more tolerable for my listeners to do that. So I'm going to do one more. Let's focus on executives. You know, you cite in the book, of course, the famous Enron and WorldCom, and more recently, Wells Fargo. You quote a number of executives who say if they don't cheat, their organizations can't compete, and then no one has a job.
Yeah.
What would you say to such an executive to get him or her to change their view and in turn change the organization's culture?
Well, I'd say plenty of companies manage to thrive without massive cheating, and if yours can't, you need to rethink the organization's business model. And from a long-term perspective, we know that creating cultures of integrity provides a much more sustainable path to profit than cutting corners or engaging in systematic fraud or overlooking employees who do. Look what happened to the business reputation and legal cost for Wells Fargo. And of course, Enron bit the dust, creating huge hardships for thousands of employees and investors. So, you know, you need to consider the long-term reputational consequences as well as the short-term financial advantages.
Absolutely, and so did Arthur Andersen. And more importantly, if you're a good worker, if you're really good, why would you want to work for a sleazy firm? So you're going to, even if it may be a little bit opaque, slowly, invariably, your really good people are going to leave. So, you know, I couldn't agree with you more on this. One more corporate example. Then I want to go to the phones and give our listeners a chance to call in. As I said in the introduction, even when employee cheating costs lives, people do it. And you cite GM with their ignition starter and Volkswagen with their pollution control thing that they didn't, they cheated on their data that they reported on pollution control in their cars. Would you read in the middle of page 41?
Yeah, I got it.
Starting with at General Motors, and read just to the end of that paragraph.
Yep. At General Motors, employees were told not to use terms such as defect, safety, or problem in writing reports, which prevented open discussion of ignition switch failures. At Volkswagen, falsified emissions test results were partly attributable to managers who reportedly said something like, "Please think again on that, and if you don't find a solution, we may need to find another engineer." When litigation was imminent, in-house lawyers advised employees that emission-related data should be kept, quote, only if necessary, which led to the illegal destruction of thousands of documents.
Yep, yeah, which of course does remind me, again, trying to be fair, I stipulated to President Trump's unethical behavior, but we also know that Hillary Clinton hired a bleaching firm to bleach thousands of emails. Unfortunately, as you said, I think our political process really desperately, our financing desperately calls for changes. I guess that's a good place to, before I go to the phones. What kind of, let's say you were Wells Fargo. Let's say, no, you were John Strumpf. I guess he had to retire. He was the CEO. Good. But let's say the new CEO of Wells Fargo comes in and says, damn it, we are going to be a really clean organization, not even, you know, relatively minor. We're not even going to tolerate really, really minor things. And you, Deborah Rhode, professor of legal professor and a founder of the Sanford Center on Ethics and author of the book Cheating, what would be your top three prescriptions for that CEO, him or her, to really relatively permanently reduce cheating at Wells Fargo?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think organizations that want to reduce cheating need to focus on their ethical culture and all the formal rules, policies, and reward structures, as well as the informal norms and expectations that influence members' behavior. And they need to assess the extent of the problem that they have, where it's located, what the causes are, and they need to integrate ethical concerns into all of their activities, especially performance evaluation and reward systems. And secondly,
let me comment on that one first, then I'll get to the second one.
Yeah.
I think it really is an art to balance extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. It's only the idealistic among us that can say we can inculcate intrinsic motivation and realize that people, if they realize all of the externality, negative effects that accrue from cheating, that you that will get more people to behave well ethically. I think that's only partly a part solution. I do think that people, and I think your book says this, responds well to accountability, that that they are much more likely to get caught, that policing matters, and that, in fact, that there will be punishments with teeth for unethical behavior. So it really requires both carrots and sticks. Do you agree?
I do.
Yeah. Okay, you said there was a second thing you would do as the consultant.
Right, yeah, you gave me three.
Right.
So the second thing is focus on leadership. One consistent finding of research on organizational culture is the significance of leaders' own ethical commitments and behaviors.
Yep.
They set a moral tone and a moral example by their own behavior, and employees often take cues from those in supervisory positions.
Yep.
And again, you know, Wells Fargo is a case history in what not to do, since over a decade, despite evidence of widespread fraud, the only individuals who were ever held accountable were low-level employees, not the leaders.
Before you get to the third one, you know, to use another animal analogy, we're talking about the, you know, the boiling, the slowly, the frog where we're turning up the heat. I think that, let me see, I've now lost it. Fish rots from the top, you know?
Yeah, right.
Right. Okay, you have a third key recommendation?
Yeah, I think the third is that workplaces need more safe spaces for moral disagreement, more protection for whistleblowers, more ethical climate surveys, hotlines, ethics officers, and so forth. The problem in too many organizations, as one consultant put it, is not only does no one want to listen, but nobody wants to talk about not listening. So you need to create a culture in which people view this as a priority and work together to try to structure appropriate responses.
I agree. I think there the people who would object say we don't want to create a culture of snitching, but I think then you know nothing is clearly black and white. I think the net benefit of a culture of anonymous reporting, while there could be false reporting, they want to get somebody in trouble, this and that, I think the net, from a utilitarian perspective, the net benefit outweighs liability. You buy that?
Yeah.
Okay, now is a good time to go to the phones. Dear listeners, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I am having a good time talking with my, hopefully you are too, listening to our conversation. I'm talking with Deborah Rhode. She is the founding director of Stanford's Center on Ethics and the author of a new book, which I really commend to you. It is concise, easy read, and yet authoritative, well-cited. The book is called Cheating, Ethics in Everyday Life. The book covers everything, not just in the workplace, but because this show's mandate, its parameters are to be delimited to work. I'm focusing on that. But you will see maybe to make you squirm a bit, lots of examples across. I'm just going to take a moment to just show you the category, read you the categories. So cheating in sports, cheating in organizations, cheating on taxes, cheating in academia, media and plagiarism in professional settings, copyright infringement, cheating in insurance and mortgages, cheating in marriage. So you'll it covers a broad range, all within the space of about 200 pages, so I do commend it to you. But now, I'll give out the phone number. If you have a question or a comment for Deborah Rode, that author of Cheating, about us, but let's focus on the workplace, I invite you to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And before I even give out the phone number, the calls are coming in. Let's go right to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Are you there?
Hello.
Hello.
I'm here.
And you are on the air. What is your question or comment for Deborah Rode?
Okay, I spent 30 years in retained executive search, but this has nothing to do with it. CPA firm, three trustees, three owners of a corporation, and they have a fight. Mm-hmm. So they bring in a major bank to take over the situation as a successor trustee, and the banks and the CPA firm says, oh, we don't have to report to the individual three trustees that weren't fighting with each other. We now report to the bank. And mayhem ensues. Lots of money gets charged. Great on ethics. It's not in California. It's another state. And what's the CPA's responsibility in this? They have the faults being pointed out to them by the intelligent one of the owners, the people that inherited, and the CPA firm just ducks it.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, what would you say in the situation?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. I totally, you know, have the factual context,
right, sure.
But maybe the details don't matter so much. I look, accountants are there to provide reassurance to the public generally that all the transactions that they're signing off on or saying don't need to be signed off on are in fact honest and satisfy legal standards. And if the accountants fell short in this context, they ought to be held accountable.
I want to thank you for the call. Before I go back to the phones, I've been trying to urge a sense of realism here, but I'm going to take a moment to be very sanctimonious myself and get your reaction. I can't think of anything more important to a society that runs well than that trust issue you mentioned earlier. And that requires it becoming primary in everything from parenting education, showing parents what are the most important things to do in parenting, to teach them to do situations, like you said, complex situations that might be ethically tempting, and explaining why it's critical to be ethical in the schools, in the churches, in the universities, and in the media. And we wink at unethical behavior, and the commentators in sports games, for example, will kind of wink at all of that. Am I overestimating the importance of a foundation of trust as being core to the civilized society?
No, I think that's, the central point of the book, and that we're all in danger, I think, of eroding that fabric that's really essential to making our lives work well.
Yeah. And, you know, I certainly am not trying to present myself as holier than thou. I have not always been a saint. I remember as a teenager being a shoplifter, and I certainly don't feel good about having done that. But I was. Even I wasn't poor. I was a musician making good money, playing for weddings and bar mitzvahs. And yet it was the adrenaline rush, or when I felt wronged by society or whatever, I would go and steal some piece of belt or clothing belt or whatever. So I certainly don't mean to be sounding sanctimonious. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco, my special guest, Deborah Rode, the author of Cheating. What is your question or comment for her? Are you there? Hi.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Hello. I'm a retired team member from Wells Fargo. And I know you talked about Stump and Carrie Tolstead. This culture that was developed there went back to Kovacevic when Norwest bought Wells Fargo, and the branches were renamed stores, and the whole company became a sales company.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was more important to add that cent or two to Buffett's bottom line than it was to provide a workplace that was not full of fear.
And full of fear. Can you give an example of that? I want to hear an example of that. That makes all the, that feels right, because I've been a Wells Fargo customer since 1993, and I've noticed a real change to the sales orientation. Give me an example of the fear that got induced by management.
Okay, you get young people coming in out of college to come to work in the bank. And I'm not talking about wholesale or any other. I'm talking about the bank that people know. When people think of Wells or any bank, they think of the branch.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got these young folks that are coming out, and they're going to be bankers. That used to be a very respectable position to be in.
Right.
And they get in there, and they find out that they're really salespeople.
Mm.
And not only are they salespeople, they are, their feet are held to the fire to make a certain amount of sales every single day. And they are fired if they do not. They are let go within 3 months, and they're always in the danger. And it's a Ponzi scheme. I mean, there's only so many people in the world. You cannot have that many sales. And I believe that the folks at the top were responsible for a culture that was, that pushed these young people. And it was, these were the folks who lost their jobs. These are the folks who were unhirable as a banker anyplace else, because they had been caught up in this criminal enterprise that was going on there.
I so appreciate
it. And they paid the price. Kovacevich is still seen as the banker's banker. Stump took the hit because he happened to be CEO at the time. Carrie took the hit because she was the head of the, you know, that part of the banking world. No one else is even ever mentioned. No one. And those folks who lost their jobs, you know, were just left.
I really appreciate your call very much. Deborah, is there anything you want to make a comment on this, or should we turn to our next topic?
No, you have my deepest sympathy, and I think we're really seeing, the folks at the top, though, even in those cases, although they were fired, they walked away with plenty of economic security. It's all the, you know, folks lower down on the totem pole who were fired for responding to a reward structure that the company managers created and should have known would have these consequences. Those are the ones that really have my sympathy.
Let's kind of end things on maybe, you know, slightly lighter touch. As I was reading the table of contents, one of the areas you deal with is sports. And I can make a case for, there certainly are some pro athletes, and while I suspect there are relatively few pro athletes listening to the show, it might be fun to end our conversation with a few questions about that. You have a chapter, in that chapter on cheating in sports, in the middle of page 21, there is a section on that. Would you read that to us?
21, pro athletes.
Let's see. Well, you could start with cheating in the middle of the page, cheating with equipment.
Yeah. So cheating with equipment is another common technique. According to some commentators, cheating is baseball's oldest profession. Batters have used cork bats, and pitchers have put graphite, baby oil, pine tar, or Vaseline on baseballs. When accused of using a foreign substance on the ball, Don Sutton responded, "Not true at all. Vaseline is manufactured right here in the United States." Gaylord Perry was notorious for throwing illegal spitballs to achieve the wins that gained his membership in the Hall of Fame. In racing, jockeys have resorted to buzzers that give horses an electric shock to increase their speed. Tennis players have used rackets of illegal string tension, and golfers have used clubs of illegal weight or size. In football, Hall of Fame player Jerry Rice admitted to having put stick-em on his hands throughout his career to make the ball easier to catch, a practice he characterized as a little illegal.
I have to add an anecdote. One of my more amusing moments on my 28-plus years in this show is when I had Maury Wills on the show. Maury Wills was the Los Angeles Dodger, legendary, one of the greatest base stealers of all time, and he was on the show. And I said, you know, the Dodgers had a reputation for the pitchers throwing a lot of spitball, just like you mentioned with Don Sutton. And I said, how did he get away with it? And he said something on the air that could have gotten, you know, all kinds of reprisals. He said, it was me. He was a shortstop in the infield, and after every strikeout, you know, the catcher throws the ball around the infield.
Mm-hmm.
And so this Warry Wills, he would have a piece of emery cloth inside his glove, and he would scuff up the baseball, which would make the ball do dipsy doodles. So by the time it got to the pitcher, Don Sutton didn't, or Don Drysdale, who were the two most who were accused of the cheating, didn't have to do a thing. So, and he admitted this on public radio. It speaks to how inured, I guess, people can get to the cheating.
Yeah, well, you know, the fans tolerate it.
But, exactly.
You know, what's the line about hockey? People, you know, go to see the violence and then a game breaks out. You know.
Well, you know, look, we may put an asterisk next to Barry Bonds' name for breaking the home run record, but we mainly think of Barry Bonds as breaking the home run record, rather than saying, I won't go to a game or spend my dollars or buy Barry Bonds T-shirts because he used performance-enhancing drugs, which is a horrible role model for children. Is it that we really don't care much about ethics?
Well, we don't care enough.
Right.
Yeah, but, you know, I think we're certainly trying to get a handle on the doping problem, and we're making some progress, and the disqualification of Russian athletes
right.
from the Olympics is a step in the right direction.
Is it really disqualified? I thought what's going on is they're unable to say that they are residents of some...
Yeah, well, right, but they can't compete under the Russian banner, so, you know...
Slap on the wrist.
Yeah, but, you know, you take progress where you can... Get it.
I like it. Let's end on a softball question. You know, we've been talking for 42 minutes here, and we covered a lot of ground, and I'm really grateful to you. If there was one thing more that you want to either say that's new that we haven't discussed, or one thing you want to underscore before we say goodnight, what would that one thing be?
I think it's that we all need to take more responsibility for dealing with the problem and fostering ethical behavior in our own lives, and that's our workplaces, our families, and the sports field. Over a century ago, Mark Twain quipped that virtue has never been as respectable as money, and proving him wrong ought to be a greater personal and workplace priority.
Yeah, I liked you using earlier in the show the word aspirational. It's so we may not all ever be saints, but it's certainly worth aspiring to, as that book could be that inspiration for aspiring to greater ethics, if not perfect ethics. Again, the book is Cheating, subtitle Ethics in Everyday Life, Not Just in the Workplace, broadly defined. Deborah Rhode, again, thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Be well. And now we turn to you specifically. You can talk about an ethical dilemma if you like. It's really in the workplace. It would be very interesting to hear an ethical dilemma that either if you're being really honest about yourself or something you've seen, I welcome your calling about that. And if you have, you know, a question about that, or as always, a primary focus of the show is helping you with the pragmatics of your work life. Whether you're unemployed, underemployed, or well-employed and still unhappy, either because you've got a crappy coworker, crappy boss, or you're just wondering about what the hell the meaning of life is, any work-related question for you or someone you care about is fair game to call for what I call a workover, in which no pummeling is usually involved. And I'll try to help you out. The price is certainly right. Zero, zippo, nada here at Work with Marty Nemco and KELW. 415 is the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. One of the more common calls that I get are about changing careers, whether they should change a career. And I want to prioritize you, the listener, so I'm going to go to the phones. But right after that, hopefully if I have time, I'm going to ask you five questions, true or false questions, that can help you decide whether it's time for you to change careers. But let's prioritize you. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. How can I help?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Faye. I'm calling from San Francisco. I have a situation at work where there's a lot of bullying and harassment that's been going on for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
That I've sort of tolerated it, and it's become part of the fabric of the organizational culture.
Can you be a little specific? Can you give me, you know, that those terms, bullying and harassment, can be so broadly construed. How would you give me an example or two of that embedded culture you're describing?
Okay. So, for example, getting confidential survey that was distributed, and the document leaked out. Somebody either stole it from our director's computer or, and then they distributed this confidential material regarding an employee questioning their hours or that they're receiving favoritism from the boss or something like that. And then just always this gossiping and clicks and a lot of off-work networking that results in a lot of drinking and sort of negative behavior that sort of brought up the next day in the office. And unfortunately, it's sort of our boss is a woman, and she, these are like, I don't want to give too much information, but they're like union employees that have been tolerated in a bureaucracy. They've gone their way for many, many years, and they don't really respect, and our director, she's amazing, but she sort of doesn't deal with this type of negative behavior, and it's been just going on for a long time. So I don't know, like, what could be done. Like, and the last time this document leaked and it was distributed, the HR got involved, and I was really happy about that. And they came and talked, and everybody signed a document that they said this is an example of harassment. But in overall, the culture is, it's impossible to change.
Well, maybe it is, but let me take a shot for, you know, that's my job here to try. What would happen if if I were running that group, I would do what I call press a reset, and I'll explain what that means. Is I would have an offsite if I could, if you know, if the union allowed me to, or I'd simply do, you know, I'd bring in lunch or whatever was what I could do, and I would, but a nicer lunch than usual, and I would say, I would start the conversation, and conversation is the operative word, but I would kick off the conversation with something like the following. One of the benefits we have as a unionized environment is that we get to grow old with each other. We are not family, but we get to be with each other for a long time. We're not going to be part-time temp, plugged in for 2 months and then gone. We are growing old with each other. And that means we have we create a culture, our lives are profoundly affected by this workplace. And if there is a culture of suspicion and harassment and unethical behavior and drinking and name-calling, etc., we are ruining all of our collective lives. You and I, every one of us, from the most entry-level employee to me, all are on an important mission. Whatever it is, I'm not going to even ask you, but every mission is important as long as it's ethical. Let's say, you know, can you tell me what the business is, or the nonprofit, or the government agency? What's the mission?
Government agency, transportation.
Okay, great. So I'm just going to be very vague, and I'm going to say, our job is, what could be more basic of people's lives than helping people, without undue time delay, get from their home to their work, to visit their friends, their loved ones in the hospital. And every time we do something efficiently and well, we are improving the lives of many people. And every time we get caught up in petty crap, we are hurting not only ourselves, but lots of people. I care about each and every one of you. And in fact, partly because this is a union shop and we're going to be together, we are going to be together for a long time. It's like we're married. In some sense.
Yeah.
Would, if she gave a talk like that and say, we need to press reset and try to treat each other not quite like family, but almost like the extended family that we are, would people laugh at that? Would they be good for a day and then revert back to their old self? Would they say, because I'm unionized, they can't touch me? What would happen after a speech like, and then it would start a conversation, by the way. I wouldn't just end with the lecture. I would then give everybody a chance to talk, chime in, and say there'll be no retribution. We want to hear your candor. How can we make this place better? What constructive ideas do you have, dear workers? Would that fail or succeed in your particular workplace?
We've done that a numerous times, unfortunately. We've had off-site retreats.
Wow.
We've had outside intermediaries like consultants and coaches come in to do team-building exercises. But unfortunately, people are used to it. It's a lot of like denial of assignments as well. More exciting assignments that involves travel and more, exciting work. You know, that's also what HR said was a form of racism. Like it should, not racism, sorry, like denial and, how do you say it? Denying of assignments.
Let's just say an unfairness.
Yeah. Yeah, and discrimination, basically, for some person compared. If we're all equal, and it should be equal opportunity. But, I mean, it's just, I was very pro-labor before this job. But since I've been working with unions, I am so against it. Because in principle, it's a great idea. But in actuality, it sort of becomes a really environment of, like, mafia sort of environment, actually.
What, mafia? I don't understand that. Why would a unionized environment create a mafia-like environment?
Yeah, it's just intimidation and people used to having their ways. And, you know, there was a lot of anonymous letters about individuals in the department, mostly the department head, written and sent to press, sent to the director of our agency. And it's kind of like Unibomber-esque.
But wait, hold on. One more question. Why does it have to, couldn't that occur equally in a non-unionized environment? People writing anonymous notes and spreading bad information. Why are you placing the blame on the face of the feet of the union?
Because based on my professional experience, I've been in non-union environment, that kind of behavior. I mean, even in a government agency like City Hall, if you behave that way, you're out. You're fired the next day. It's unacceptable. Maybe you get a written warning a few times, but then after that, they let you go. But unfortunately, this sort of environment, and it's been tolerated for so long, you know?
Yeah. Anyway, I want to thank you for the call.
Okay, thank you. Thank
you. A little dispiriting. I promised you before that call that I was going to address the question of when is it really time to change careers? Sometimes a tweak's just not going to do. Not only because a career is a misfit, because sometimes a career misery is, you know, like this person here. She's in an environment, doesn't matter whether unionized or not. It's a, to use the common parlance, a toxic workplace. And sometimes you say that, you know, I can't stay within this industry. It's a small industry. Everybody knows each other. If I leave, yeah, sometimes you need to change careers. But also sometimes the career misery lies within the person, and that person will bring their unhappiness to the next career, having expended a lot of time and usually a lot of money for nothing. So here are five questions that may help you decide whether for you it's wise for you to change careers. True or false? Number one, you're confident that your unhappiness in this career is unfixable. It won't just help to change employers or adjust your job responsibilities, or gain a new skill, or a new attitude. For example, there was a psychologist who consistently got poor results. She was working for a government agency, and she was well-mentored. And despite being well-mentored, she knew that she just wasn't cut out to be a good psychologist. Or a salesperson gets ever more call reluctant, even though the product is a good one. That person probably needs to change careers. Or a journalist who finds it impossible to make a living at journalism because today there are all those citizen journalists willing to write for free or me to do this radio show for free. So true or false, you're confident that your unhappiness in this career is unfixable. Second true or false question, and by the way, this is not, you don't have to have all five yes, trues, or false, but this is just a way to trigger your thinking about whether you should change careers too. True or false, after sufficient reflection and internet research, and maybe informational interviewing, you've become confident that you would be happier and more successful in a particular new career. Number three, true or false, you have the time and money to afford retraining, and often a pay cut, because if you're a beginner in a new career, it's, you know, you're often not going to get the same money as you got when you were in this existing career when you had a lot of experience. Number four, true or false, you're confident that even with or even without much training, that you would be employable in your new career. For example, you know the job market is good for people who are newly trained in this field. Or, you know, for example, the field of artificial intelligence is wildly popular now, and so even relative newbies can at least get some project work. Or you happen to know somebody who would likely hire you, whether the job market is good or not. So true or false, that you're confident that with or even without much training, you'd be employable in your new career. And the fifth question that can help you decide whether it's time to change careers is true or false. You're confident that if you made the aforementioned career change, that you would, in fact, be happier and more successful. Those may help you decide whether or not you want to consider a career change. But I've certainly learned over the years that it is easier to make radical career changes into certain careers. Sure, there's a few social workers who in midlife relaunch their career to become a rocket scientist or vice versa. But they're rare enough that they're the ones who get onto Oprah. Here are some careers that a higher percentage of people have switched to and found satisfying. It's a little ironic in light of the previous caller, but many times people find more satisfaction in changing careers to being a government employee, as a manager, as an analyst, or a coordinator, because they're craving security. And like the caller said, you can't get rid of, though, not in all government positions, but in many. And there are many people who said, you know, I appreciated the go-go of the startup environment, but, you know, I'm now a lot happier in my government stable job. And when 5 o'clock comes, I can go home. I get full benefits. I get lots of vacation days and holidays, and personal leave days. And there are a number of people, and it's relatively easier. No career change is easy. But moving from take your transferable skills that you may have had in the private sector or the nonprofit sector and using them to get a job in government as a manager, analyst, or coordinator is often a successful route for career changes. I only have time for one more. Since we talked a little bit about politician dishonesty, I'm obsessed with this balance thing. Many people want to make a difference. And while the wheels of government turn very slowly, the massive size of government allows at least the potential to make a big difference. No, you're not going to start out as the chairman of the Senate Ways and Means Committee, but many people make at least a part-time living in an entry-level politician career. For example, member of the school board or parks commission. So, and that could be, you know, there are people who are in a variety of different careers that have switched into politics. And one more that's politician-related, being a campaign manager. If you're intrigued by being in politics but are better at handling details and managing people or in marketing than being the front person, that's something that also people change a lot, have often successfully changed to. I'll do more next week, but that's all the time we've got today on Work with Marty Nemco. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening. Your intelligent, thoughtful, and candid calls, I love you. Please join me again next Thursday at 7 p.m. See, the show has been moved. It was 28 years of Sunday. Now it's Thursdays from 7 to 8 p.m. You can call in for a workover. Plus, I'll talk with the reigning world champion magician, Shin Lim, on the psychology of influencing people and the implications for all of us in the workplace. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't. We'll be right back.